this at WJBC this week.
It's a long-term investment. We're thinking on the long game here.
In Bloomington, we've got to get our act together and move forward.
I have to acknowledge that one of my few regrets is my inability to reduce the polarization and meanness in our politics.
We've had failure in our elected government for decades.
The state is not broke. The state is not broke. The 1% need to pay their fair share in taxes.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, President Obama addresses the Illinois legislature in a rare presidential speech in Springfield. And we have a reaction from a local lawmaker. A Bloomington alderman discusses a proposed $50 million downtown redevelopment. Local economic developers discuss a business survey intended to lure more air travel to Bloomington Normal. Plus, a food writer and historian explains why we love and hate certain foods. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. President Barack Obama returned this week to the place where his political career began, Springfield, Illinois, as he spoke before the state legislature, addressing lawmakers about their budget stalemate, which is now in its eighth month. He vowed to repair the political damage, quote, before it threatens everything we leave our kids.
So that's what's on my mind as I come back to Illinois today. This is what will be a focus of mine over the course of this year and beyond. What can we do, all of us, together, to try to make our politics better? And I speak to both sides on this. Because all of you know it could be better. And all of you would feel prouder of the work you do if it was better. So first, let's put to rest a couple of myths about our politics. One is the myth that the problems with our politics are new. They are not. American politics has never been particularly gentle or high-minded, especially not during times of great change. As I mentioned when I visited a mosque in Maryland last week, Thomas Jefferson's opponent tried to stir things up by suggesting he was a Muslim. So I'm in good company. But that's nothing compared to the newspaper, which warned that if Jefferson were elected, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. His vice president, Aaron Burr, literally killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel. I don't want to even tell you what Andrew Jackson's opponent said about his mama. Lincoln himself was routinely called weak, wishy-washy, a yahoo, an unshapely man, the obscene ape of Illinois, and my favorite, a facetious pettifogger. I don't know what that means, but it sounds insulting. So, comparatively speaking, today is not that bad, as long as you've got a thick skin. As Harold Washington once said, politics ain't beanbag. It's tough. And that's okay. There's also the notion sometimes that our politics are broken because politicians are significantly more corrupt or beholden to big money than they used to be. Now, there's no doubt that lobbyists still have easier access to the halls of power than the average American. There's a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that the system works for ordinary people and not just the well-connected. That's true at the federal level. That's true at the state level. Folks aren't entirely wrong when they feel as if the system too often is rigged and does not address their interests. But relative to the past, listen, I'm confident we've got enough rules and checks to prevent anyone in my cabinet from siphoning whiskey tax revenue into their own pockets like President Grant's administration did. Until FDR went after the ward bosses of Tammany Hall, they controlled judges and politicians as they pleased. Patronage, bribery, money laundering. It's not as easy as it was to whip up tens of thousands of phantom votes, whether in Chicago or South Texas. From the Teapot Dome to Watergate, history tells us we should always be vigilant and demand that our public servants follow the highest ethical standards. But the truth is that the kind of corruption that is blatant, of the sort that we saw in the past, is much less likely in today's politics. And the Justice Department and the media work hard to keep it that way. And that's a very good thing. So we don't want to romanticize the past and think somehow it's a difference in the people being elected. And it also isn't true that today's issues are inherently more polarizing than the past. Remember, we endured 4 years of civil war. It resulted in hundreds of thousands of dead Americans. This country was divided on a fundamental question. Before Pearl Harbor, entering into World War II was a highly charged debate. The fault lines of Vietnam, the culture wars of the 60s, they still echo into our politics a half century later. We've been arguing since our founding over the proper size and role of government, the meaning of individual freedom and equality, over war and peace, and the best way to give all of our citizens opportunity. And these are important debates that everybody should join with all the rigor that a free people require. My point is, the problem is not that politicians are worse. The problem is not that the issues are tougher. And so it's important for us to understand that the situation we find ourselves in today is not somehow unique or hopeless. We've always gone through periods when our democracy seems stuck. And when that happens, we have to find a new way of doing business. We're in one of those moments. We've got to build a better politics, one that's less of a spectacle and more of a battle of ideas. One that's less of a business and more of a mission. One that understands the success of the American experiment rests on our willingness to engage all our citizens in this work. And that starts by acknowledging that we do have a problem, and we all know it. What's different today is the nature and the extent of the polarization. How ideologically divided the parties are. It's brought about by some of the same long-term trends in our politics and our culture. The parties themselves have become more homogeneous than ever. A great sorting has taken place. It drove Southern conservatives out of the Democratic Party, Northern moderates out of the Republican Party. So you don't have within each party as much diversity of views. And you've got a fractured media. Some folks watch Fox News. Some folks read the Huffington Post. And very often, what's profitable is the most sensational conflict and the most incendiary soundbites. And we can choose our own facts. We don't have a common basis for what's true and what's not. I mean, if I listened to some of these conservative pundits, I wouldn't vote for me either. I sound like a scary guy. You've got advocacy groups that, frankly, sometimes benefit from keeping their members agitated as much as possible, assured of the righteousness of their cause. Unlimited dark money, money that nobody knows where it's coming from, who's paying, drowns out ordinary voices. And far too many of us surrender our voices entirely by choosing not to vote. And this polarization is pervasive, and it seeps into our society to the point where surveys even suggest that many Americans wouldn't want their kids to date someone from another political party. Now, some of us don't want our kids dating, period, but that's a losing battle.
That was part of President Obama's hour-long address to the Illinois legislature this week. WJBC's Dan Swaney got reaction from Republican State Representative Dan Brady.
What was the atmosphere like in the chambers when President Obama came in? Can you just kind of give us a feel on what you thought?
I think the atmosphere is quite relaxed. I thought that the president hit a number of chords straight to the heart of what politics has become in the way of some of the divisiveness that goes on. I think he showed a history of a president and senator and U.S. senator that has been through a number of battles and tried to explain some of the things that we need to work on and come together on, and brought it here to his home, to Illinois, where there's probably the biggest divide budget-wise going on that there is in the country right now.
Yeah. Now, did you serve directly with Barack Obama when he was in the House there?
I was in the House when President Obama was in the state Senate across the chamber. But why I interacted with him on legislation, I did not serve in the Senate at the time with Senator Obama.
But you knew
Senator Brady would have.
You knew him and you did some work with him, didn't you?
Yeah, we had worked on some legislation dealing with insurance together back in the Senate days. And that's really where I got to have a little exposure to him. Very limited, but worked together on a bipartisan front of legislation dealing with insurance, particularly some language and insurance contracts. But, you know, I think that his visit here today was just a reminder of all the things that we need to work on. I brought my son Tom Brady, who's an eighth grader at Evans Junior High, and he was in the gallery, in the speaker's gallery, and got to partake and listen to the speech today and give the president a big wave. So I think it was great, a little lesson in government and politics for him.
Good for you, Dan. That's great that you did that for your son. The general tone of President Obama's speech seemed to be relaxed and almost like a mentoring type speech. Did you kind of get that feeling too?
I think so. First off, relaxed because he's back home. He's back home where he's very comfortable. He spent a lot of time in this chamber. In fact, got a signature from him for a picture of me and I together. Before he left to give the one of the key speeches at the Democratic National Convention when he was then getting ready to run for U.S. Senate, which really launched his career, this speech, if you may remember. Mm-hmm. And that speech mimicked a lot of things he said today, and that was of coming together, where we can find common ground. You know, and if you stand up for something against the grain of your party, it doesn't mean you're some traitor. It means that you're trying to do what people want to see done, and that is work, compromise, and get something accomplished. And those are the things that many times, more often than not, have to be done, and the lines that have to cross sometimes to get something.
There were a couple of moments in the speech where he got huge applause. I was listening on the radio, so I couldn't actually see what was going on in the chamber. But one of them was when he went to list what things people who are in government should do, and the last one was get a budget or prepare a budget, and that got a huge round of applause. I was a little, not totally surprised, but it surprised me a little bit about how well that was received.
Well, I don't think there's anybody down here that doesn't want to get a budget. It's what kind of budget we get. We've been around the horn on that. But what was encouraging was you know, the governor and the president speaking a little bit. The president did touch upon the area of redistricting, which has been a strong point of the governor, some of his turnaround agenda points that he wants. But still, on the other side, you know, he kept the grass cutting. He didn't go one side or the other too far. He said it was, you know, good for Democrats sometimes, it's bad for Republicans. It was bad for Republicans, or good for Republicans, bad for Democrats. We all have to find that common place and balance these things out. And he also highlighted from history, you know, many of these problems aren't new, but the way things have gotten over the years and the way structured parties are, you know, even within their own parties, the divisiveness that goes on there. And so I think, obviously, it was warmly received, and it was good to have the president back here at home in the Illinois legislature.
That was State Representative Dan Brady with Dan Swaney. Bloomington aldermen will review an updated proposal this week from developer Jeff Gabelhausen for a $50 million downtown hotel and conference center where the Commerce Bank and Front and Center buildings stand. The city initially turned back a proposal in the fall. Bloomington alderman Scott Black discussed the plan and how U.S. Cellular Coliseum plays a role as he talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Where are we at with this?
Absolutely. And downtown development's a key piece. I think it's been a conversation for a long time, and we're starting to see some really energetic developers come forward with some projects. You know, we had David Bentley come in. We had Jeff Gabelhausen come in. About a year or so ago, we had Gabelhausen present a proposal that ultimately wasn't what the council was looking for, so he's come back. I think that there's a lot of interest in downtown Bloomington, specifically at the corner front and center, and also by the Coliseum there. And we're going to be hearing a report back from our SB Friedman consultants. They've done some numbers, looked at some more data, because we're a very analytical council. We want to get all the facts on the table. If there's going to be some skin in the game from the city, we want to make sure our investment it would be protected and there's a public good behind it. So I'm really excited for that. That'll be next Tuesday at 5:30 at City Hall, and we're going to hear what they have to say and get some details sorted out.
Now, you talk about skinning the game from the city. We're talking money, and it's very likely that the city will have to put up some cash in order to make something happen.
I wouldn't say put up some cash. What we'd be doing is taking some pieces of the future tax revenue generated from the building towards the project. So right now, we're not getting any hotel-motel tax from that piece. We're not getting any food and beverage tax from that property. So if we were to have to do something where there'd be some bonding, maybe it's for parking, maybe it's for something else, that would be rebated, and that's something that you know, we're not going to spend a single dollar out of our city's budget today towards that project. We'd be rebating the future earnings off of that project.
What do you think of that latest design that it shows a skywalk across in those two buildings? It would be a major rehab instead of a knockdown start over project.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great. And I think it's something that captures the historic nature of downtown Bloomington. I think that's been a real key piece. We've seen a really a big increase in visitors to downtown Bloomington since the Route 66 Visitor Center, McLean County History Museum, seeing increase in visitors. These are things that people want to come and visit and see that heritage. And being able to preserve that while putting kind of a modern twist to it, I think, is a no-brainer.
I think it doesn't take very long to figure out that whenever you guys talk about helping with a project in any way, you will have people come forward and say, fix my streets first. Fix the garbage deficit first. You're going to get those naysayers who try to stop the project of spending money downtown. What do you say to those people?
Yeah, they're very fair concerns. And you know, I think people will come back and say priorities, priorities, priorities. But, you know, to me, economic development is a key piece of our future in our community. And right now, that property is not generating the revenue that it can for our city. And if we can do something to make it generate more revenue, that's more money in our street budget. That's more money for police, for firemen. It's a long-term investment. We're thinking on the long game here. And I tend to think, you know, if we were to, you know, we were looking at the streets 2.0 for additional bonding for that. You know, we're seeing investments in our infrastructure, key piece. You know, some people will say, you know, that the city council spends too much money on wants and not needs. I think that's fundamentally wrong. If you look since, you know, at least I've been elected in 2013, we've put more money in streets. We did the $10 million bond. We're putting in our investments and we're putting our money where our mouths are, and that's a key piece for me. But that said, we need to be looking at our underperforming properties and doing what we can to ensure Bloomington's economic future.
Another part of this proposal would be a new parking garage connected to U.S. Cellular Coliseum. But the one concern that I keep hearing is, do we have enough going on downtown to keep those rooms filled? Are there enough events next to each other at U.S. Cellular Coliseum to keep those rooms filled?
I think you'll see that with those type of rooms and more people down there, that more events will come. You know, we'd always like to see the Coliseum, you know, do as well as possible. You know, we want to see it be successful. And I think, you know, you have some people that will say that it's not doing as well as it can. And I think it's a very narrow view of it. You know, for instance, I was downtown when they had Jason Aldean come in, and it was on a Saturday. You know, I went to a couple different places downtown. It was packed everywhere before the show. during the show and after the show. I mean, those people aren't there just because they want to hang out. They're there for a key event. And, you know, it, how do you capture that as part of, you know, the Coliseum? And I think that when we invest properly in the Coliseum, we're going to see some real gains for our taxpayers, and it's going to be a really good thing for our community.
Are you comfortable with the job Central Illinois Arena Management is doing with the Coliseum?
You know, I think that, you know, we're in talks with them, and, you know, I know that the contract is up and we've been having some discussions. And, you know, from where I sit, it's always something that can be looked at, and we always want to see improved efficiencies. And, you know, we take their feedback and they take ours.
I know you're looking at it, but are you unhappy that it's always, not always, but when they issue press releases, it says we do have a loss for this quarter? And I've seen that consistently. And then they point out that there's money being spent in the community because it has a large community impact. But yet, they're not turning a profit, and they haven't for quite some time.
For me, it's about showing the public everything that we're doing and SIAM is doing to really highlight their successes. I mean, the industry itself has some challenges, and I think you can, you know, cherry pick some data and say maybe it's not meeting our expectations. But, you know, I think it's, you got to capture how many people came in and stayed overnight, how many people were, you know, spending money in the bars and restaurants because of the shows that were happening. And that's not necessarily captured in some of the, that information. So a lot of the feedback I get from people is that they wish there was more marketing, you know, there was better information about shows, or I would have seen that if I had heard about it. And we relay that feedback, and I think they've made some really good adjustments towards that. But from where I sit, I think we need to be doing everything we can to encourage downtown development, get people down there, events that are happening, and people like that.
That was Bloomington Alderman Scott Black with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Local economic developers are surveying businesses within a two-hour radius to see how much they use Central Illinois Regional Airport in Bloomington and how they might use it more to help CIRA attract additional flights. Kyle Hamm, president of the McLean County Economic Development Council, and CIRA director Carl Olson discussed the survey and the future of the Mitsubishi Motors plant with Scott and Colleen.
Do you have suspicions about the reach and the, you know, spread and that our airport, it, how many businesses we're attracting from that far away?
Well, we know that Central Illinois Regional Airport sits in the middle of the second largest population concentration in the state after Chicago. There's 1.8 million residents within 90 minutes of CIRA. And there's a lot of business and a lot of industry in that area, as well as leisure travel. For example, you look up Interstate 39 to the LaSalle-Pruitt area. That's a community of over 100,000 people. And there are good, strong employers up there that are doing business travel. And partnering with the EDC gives us an opportunity for the Airport Authority to better identify who these businesses are, where they travel, introduce CIRA and our community to them, not only for investment, but for travel purposes. So that's why this is going to work. I think we're excited to think this is going to work out well.
And I imagine a place like LaSalle, you bring up LaSalle, LaSalle-Pruitt area, you're getting into that gray area where people are probably looking at, well, I could go out of Midway or I could go out of Bloomington. Well, I mean, you're going to win me over because yes, parking's free in Bloomington.
And the travel's,
traffic's a lot easier, yeah.
Exactly. But sometimes because maybe the media outlets that they have, they're more attractive, they're more aware of the Chicagoland area. So part of this is to identify the targets, and part of it is to help introduce ourselves to them.
Yeah. So it'll be part of a larger effort going through 2016 to identify the travel, what businesses are doing. I mean, you'd be surprised what local businesses are doing here. We have companies locally that fly to the Philippines on a regular basis, that fly to Germany on a regular basis. And so just knowing that and understanding that, we can help build a case with the airlines. Midway is, if you've ever flown out of Midway or O'Hare, it's a nightmare. And we want to make the case to those that live on that fringe up north that there's an alternative way to travel, and that's CIRA.
And Rockford is also another alternative, isn't it, for that market up there?
It is. They have air service, but it's the leisure non-scheduled service. Like, it's more of the non-regular schedule, like an Allegiant. They don't have the daily business type service that we have with a mainland carrier.
Okay, that's helpful to know. So, yeah, so the survey is also serving as a marketing tool in a way, right?
It is a marketing tool for us to understand our market and our businesses, but then we're going to look at creative ways to start doing some of those marketing efforts. One of those is we're working with ISU's SMAC Center, which is their social media analytics command center. And what they do is they analyze all kinds of social media. And so anybody that's talking about CIRA, talking about travel, airlines, we'll be able to capture that data and understand what people are talking about and how do we compare to other airports. What are, you know, are they getting more hits than we are? And so we're just trying to continually push the envelope through technology to be more competitive.
All right. So the survey goes out to whom again?
We've sent it out to all of our local businesses here in McLean County, and we're also working on some networks through Kankakee and Will counties and some of those LaSalle fringe counties to the north, Pontiac, working with their EDCs and chambers as well to see if we can access their businesses.
All right, the I-39 corridor.
Exactly.
There you go. So what else is going on in the world of the EDC? Do we get somebody? I'm just going to come out and ask you. You got an occupant for Mitsubishi yet?
Not yet, but it'll be exciting when we do get to announce that, right? Because you ask me every month.
Time. Well, I have to.
That's right.
Colleen would kill me if I didn't, and then we find out the next day or later in the afternoon, oh, by the way.
Yeah.
But are you still getting inquiries?
Absolutely. We continue to get inquiries. We've had several visits just in the last 2 weeks. So there's continue to be activity. I'm going to be in Chicago today working with some site consultants. We're also looking at maybe going to Germany in April for a large-scale manufacturing trade show to really highlight this site as well. So we're going to continue to press hard and make sure everybody knows about this property and get it reused.
Have you done anything with the Chicago Auto Show? Did you do any marketing up there?
You know, the auto show is really geared towards the consumer, you know, with sales of new vehicles and things. And so it's really not a place that we would go to market with. You know, you're not going to have the folks there that are doing assembly and productivity. But, you know, we're continuing to target those companies. We still think automotive is still viable, but we're also looking at alternative types of manufacturing.
Do you get the sense that automotive, that anybody who was interested from the automotive sector has taken a look, has done some due diligence, and are out, or are there still some pending interests?
You know a property this size, even if somebody was interested today, would take probably 2 years to get it up and running. And so when you're thinking about a, you know, ultimately a, over $1 billion type of building, if you were to build that thing new, it's a lot of logistics and infrastructure to think about. And so the due diligence process for an automaker is long. And so we know that people are still looking at it, doing the due diligence. And to make that type of investment long term is a huge decision for any automaker. So
what's the price tag on that piece of property?
We don't have a price tag. I mean, that's up to Mitsubishi. They own the property. But
what kind of questions are you being asked by people that are inquiring?
They ask about the area. They ask about, the corridors of our interstate systems, the rail lines, of course, our airport. Any connectivity with our airport is important for any type of freight that might come in.
And those are all positives. I mean, you'd love to answer those questions.
We love to sell McLean County and talk about our assets, our skilled workforce here, our educated skilled workforce here. We talk about relationships with ISU and Heartland, Wesleyan, if there's apprenticeship programs that need to be established. So anything that would be of benefit to anyone that wants to use that facility, we're trying to highlight.
That was Kyle Hamm with the McLean County EDC and Carl Olson of Central Illinois Regional Airport with Scott and Colleen. We all have foods that we love and foods that we hate. Food author and historian B. Wilson delves into how we learn to eat with the book First Bite. She talked with WJBC's Steve Fass this week.
When it comes to what shapes our palate, researchers and food scientists have long looked for answers to why and when we learn to like things. And there's been a long list of this research. Tell us, for instance, about Dr. Clara Davis. What did she find?
Yes, this was an amazing experiment done in the 1920s and 30s. It would never be allowed today. Dr. Davis more or less kidnapped some babies, 15 of them, and put them in an experimental orphanage. Some of them were orphans. Some of them actually had single parents. This is why I'm saying it's an unethical experiment. But what she found was fascinating. She wanted to see what children's taste would be like if they were totally free of all the usual influences of a parent saying, I want you to eat this, or this food is good and this food is bad. And the children were just offered an array of whole, pure, unprocessed foods, ranging from beets to raw beef to milk to peaches to lettuce. And what she found was, first of all of the 15 had different patterns of taste. But secondly, it didn't really seem to matter what pattern of foods they chose. They all ended up feeding themselves well, and the ones that arrived at the hospital with diseases like rickets managed to cure themselves. So that shows that naturally babies do gravitate towards different flavors. But my argument is that the experiment has been misread. Some people look at that and think, oh, kids will just be fine, just leave them to themselves. They can eat what they like. It will all come out in the wash. But actually, as Dr. Davis herself said, the real test would be offering kids a choice between sugary, salty, fatty junk foods and the whole pure unprocessed ones. Yes, if you're only offered a choice between lettuce, peaches and beef, it doesn't really matter which one you like. But as we all know, we're not learning to eat in that environment.
Well, so much good science does begin with kidnapping. when you look at this, though, this experiment got the parent influence factor out of it. And I'm wondering, what does research say about our preferences when it comes to food? Is it mostly learned?
It is mostly learned. I mean, I was astonished to find this. I didn't really know when I began writing this book. I certainly didn't know that the subtitle was going to be How We Learn to Eat. Because I think I, in common with most of us, kind of thought, well, maybe there's a learned element, but likes and dislikes, they seem such a strong part of personality. I know looking at my own three kids, they all eat in completely different ways. One of them's really picky. One of them's super omnivorous. The other's kind of in between. And I just thought, well, probably genes or something innate, something fixed. But the more I looked into the science, the neuroscience, but also the history and culture of it, sure, there's a genetic component. You can see from twin studies that some babies actively enjoy drinking milk more than others. But what can't be explained by genes and by sort of innate factors is whether someone overall eats a varied and balanced diet. That's a question largely of exposure. And that's good news because it means that, yes, you might start off as someone picky, but you can probably end up in a completely different, much happier place with your eating.
Well, you say that you might start off as being a picky eater, and we might come out of the womb liking or disliking a food, but what went on in the womb is surprisingly part of how we learn to like and dislike what we eat.
Yes, this amazed me. The learning about food, the learning about flavors, it starts before we're even born. It starts in utero. There were a series of fascinating experiments done by these scientists, Beauchamp and Minella. And one of them, they got pregnant women to drink a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy. They found when their babies were born, they actively preferred carrot-flavored cereal when they were first weaned onto solid food, which is an amazing example of how we're imprinted with flavors. So by the time we're aware of having preferences, we have no memory of having learnt them, but it really demonstrates that exposure is a powerful thing. We're born with these memories of our mother's diet, and the same goes with breast milk. That might be flavored garlicky if your mother eats a lot of garlic. But again, we just internalize it and think, oh, I'm a garlic lover, or oh, I'm a chocoholic, I'm a carnivore, and then we don't imagine we can change.
We're talking with Bea Wilson. Her book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, gets into the scientific studies of how our palates are formed and when they're formed. So you mentioned that we have these external influences, whether it be what your mother's eating or the things that you're exposed to as a baby that make us like or dislike certain foods. But that genetic component you mentioned, is there something about our palate, how our taste buds develop as infants that puts us on any kind of level playing field for liking or disliking a certain thing? Are we predisposed to dislike bitter foods, for instance?
We're all, as human beings, predisposed to dislike bitter foods. But if you look at the fact that the world's two most popular beverages are coffee and beer, we're clearly capable of overcoming that aversion. It's just that if we don't somehow get quite the same payoff from eating bitter green vegetables that we do from drinking a cup of French press coffee or an IPA, but it's still possible to overcome our aversion to bitterness. Every human being is born with a love of sweetness. This is totally cross-cultural. It makes sense. Milk is a really sweet substance. But there's nothing in our physiology that says we're doomed to grow up and love cupcakes and hate broccoli. That really isn't the case. It's totally possible through exposure to learn to love a totally different range of foods from the ones that lots of parents imagine a child ever could love. And I think that's where the Clara Davis experiment is interesting, because if you were to lock up a child to kidnap them and offer them only raw beetroot versus beef versus lettuce, there's a chance they're going to like one of those. But it's really difficult as a parent feeding a child. I know it myself because it's such an emotional act. And even without sort of feeling that you're giving your child messages, it's so hard not to offer things like salad, things like vegetables, in a totally different tone of voice from the voice with which you offer cake or candy or chocolate. One is we're offering it as a treat. And even if we're saying, I really want you to eat this other food, the child picks up on that sense of urgency and coercion and senses, why do you want me to eat this one so much? Why are you expecting me to swallow this one as if it weren't pleasure? So many of our problems with eating just come back to the fact that we see healthy food as one thing and pleasurable food as another thing.
That was food writer and historian B. Wilson with Steve Fast. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. The Bloomington City Council has again delayed a vote on a fee increase for curbside bulk waste pickup. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says two aldermen were ready to put the issue to rest, but for different reasons.
Despite the concerns of some council members, Alderwoman Diana Howman says she has full faith in city staff to effectively monitor a system where Bloomington residents have two free bulk waste pickups every year before a fee system kicks in.
We don't want to do this. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do something else. Well, it's time for us to decide what we do want to do. I say give staff a chance to work on this. They may come back and say they need to revise it, amend it somehow. If they think they can do it, I'm going to vote for it.
Alderman Kevin Lauer also wants to vote on the proposal, but he would vote against it.
We've got bigger issues with that program, and I'm afraid that we're causing more problems than we're solving here.
The other seven aldermen voted to table discussion for a later date. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Three people are in custody after a pedestrian was killed by a bus on I-39 in December. State police say 22-year-old Jeffrey Duhame of Bloomington, 20-year-old Derek Moule of Kappa, and 18-year-old Dakota Dunn of Kappa will be charged in Woodford County Court on drug-induced homicide charges. The charges stem from the death of 18-year-old Keonta Williams, who was walking along the interstate near the Kappa exit when she was hit by a bus at around 2:30 in the morning on December 19th. A brief court appearance for former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen reveals State Farm may be asked to hand over additional documents in the case. John Gregory reports.
Sorensen's attorney told a federal judge in Chicago that while the discovery process has begun, he doesn't expect to know how the defense will proceed until late March or early April, because it may decide to subpoena State Farm for more records. Sorensen has been charged with five counts of wire fraud for allegedly taking more than $400,000 in unearned consulting fees from clients, including State Farm. He pleaded not guilty last month. The rest of the hearing dealt with scheduling, particularly around Sorensen's vacation plans. He's seeking the court's permission to travel to South Carolina in March, as the terms of his bond prevent him from leaving Illinois without court approval. The next status hearing in the case is set for March 3rd. Sorensen won't be required to attend. In Chicago, John Gregory, WJBC, and WJBC.com.
The Illinois Department of Human Services held two public hearings in Bloomington this week regarding its plan to fund child care in Illinois. Gloria Harris, a mother from Chicago, testified.
In this plan, I hope that every child receives education early as possible.
Child care provider and SEIU healthcare union member Sharon Norwood has a problem with the fact the plan only funds child care assistance for families earning up to 162% of the poverty level.
Which does not cover all children. With it being 162%, 50,000 children have been left out of the program.
The union is also calling for a $15 per hour minimum wage for all child care workers. Paradise Casino in Peoria is laying off employees. although gambling revenue has increased. Boyd Gaming, the casino's operator, says video gaming has taken business away from riverboat revenue. Vice President of Corporate Communications at Boyd Gaming, David Straw, says the casino recently informed its employees of the reduction of the workforce. Just about 40 have been affected by the layoffs.
This outcome was the direct result of the expansion of video gaming that we've seen across the state of Illinois, really, for the last 3 years.
Since video gaming first began about 4 years ago, Paradise has seen about 22,000 gaming machines established across the state. Unit 5's school board has approved the sale of up to $21 million in general obligation bonds, but the district is not likely to actually sell that amount. Finance Director Marty Hickman says it's more likely Unit 5 will sell about $10 million in bonds to help with life safety projects around the district.
We actually have $30 million worth of needs in our buildings. So this is just a start, and the projects range from roof replacements to replacing water piping in some of our older schools, to renovating the HVAC systems in some of the schools.
Unit 5 had originally applied for bonds which would have had nearly all the interest paid by the federal government, but the district was not one of the 29 districts in the state selected for those bonds. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. Monday is the Federal President's Day observance. Normal's Town Council will be holding its regular meeting at a different location, accepting an invitation from the Illinois State University Student Government Association to hold its meeting at Bowen Student Center. On Tuesday, the McLean County Board will appoint a new member to fill the seat left by former Chairman Matt Sorensen as he awaits wire fraud charges. Also Tuesday, the Bloomington City Council will review a consultant's report on a proposal for major downtown redevelopment. On Thursday, Illinois State University will honor businesswoman and philanthropist Julie Domsky with an honorary doctoral degree during the university's annual Founders Day ceremonies. And Friday, the McLean County Chamber of Commerce will honor the best in agriculture when it hosts its annual Agriculture Awards Dinner. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stark.